Maximiliano Herrera, a climatologist who tracks extreme temperatures across the globe, told CNN that South America is experiencing a fierce winter heat wave. While such heat waves are not unheard of for the continent, this one has exceptional characteristics for its area, duration, intensity, and being early August. Maximiliano Herrera added, "Dozens of stations are recording their highest ever temperatures in the first half of August." August in the southern hemisphere is equivalent to February in the northern hemisphere. Chile's environment minister, Maisa Rojas, said that the world has been experiencing extreme events for weeks. "Yesterday it was a turn of South America and Chile," she said in a Twitter post on Wednesday. In the mountainous Chilean Andes region, temperatures climbed to 38.9 degrees Celsius, 102 degrees Fahrenheit, on Tuesday, 1st of August, according to Herrera, who described the event as unbelievable for midwinter and rewriting all climatic books.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
They have waited years for justice that will never come. Mark Kelly's sister, Carol Ann, was murdered during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
12 years of age. She was shot in the back of the head. She was shot behind her left ear. And there is absolutely no reason in the world that anyone can give any parent or brother or sister as to why their little sister should be murdered on her own street at the front door of her house.
Mark and hundreds more in Northern Ireland may never have closure now, under the UK government's so-called legacy bill that grants immunity to IRA volunteers and to British soldiers for historical atrocities there. It's proving a huge test for Anglo-Irish relations too. Amid a chorus of criticism from around the world, the Republic of Ireland is weighing up a human rights case against London for the first time in more than five decades.
Everyone, no matter who was affected, whether you were affected by IRA violence, paramilitary violence by the state itself, everyone has a right to justice, some kind of justice, and the very least to investigate whatever had happened to their loved ones. I mean, and that's just the basics, Article 2 of the European Convention, you know.
Under the new legislation, if anyone accused of murder gives information to a so-called truth recovery body, they'll escape prosecution, an attempt, many say, by the British government to hide the truth.
There were hundreds of IRA volunteers that went to jail during the conflict. But if we look at, in stark contrast to British soldiers or the paramilitary RUC, not one ever served a full sentence for the killing of civilians during the conflict. In fact, a number of British soldiers were let out early and given medals once they went back into the British Army. So there's a stark contrast between both. This is really about immunity for British soldiers.
The legislation is now going through the House of Lords, where it's not expected to receive any amendments. And after that, it's going to receive royal assent in just a couple of days. But the victims' families say it's not going to deter them in their pursuit for justice.
3,500 people were killed during the conflict between Protestants loyal to British rule and the majority Catholics who wanted to break away from it. 2,500 of those cases remain unresolved. And it's those who have already paid the most who are being asked to pay again. Saeed Poreza, London.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has told European Parliament Foreign and Defence Committee members that Ukraine will join the military alliance.
Ukraine has never been closer to a membership in NATO than now.
Having allegedly provoked Moscow for years, Stoltenberg was accused at the hearing of now turning his sights on Beijing under Washington's direction.
China has not illegally invaded and bombed a sovereign country in over 40 years, while the US and our allies have hardly stopped in the same period, killing millions of civilians, displacing millions more.
NATO's 31 member states have been called on to stop dithering over the question of providing long-range missiles to Ukraine.
They need these ATACMS, the long-range missiles.
Security analysts say Ukraine joining NATO and the country being supplied with long-range missiles are two moves that could trigger nuclear war. We've been asking members of the public if they are concerned.
It's so far-fetched for us as normal citizens, the thought of that, but I think it should be regarded as a possibility.
When you know that only 5 nuclear bombs can like destroy the whole planet, I don't think we're going to get to that point.
As the conflict rages on with no mention of peace negotiations, the European Commission has just cut its Eurozone economic growth forecasts. But commentators point out that wars are very lucrative for some. And in reality, they suggest, the US-led NATO alliance has nothing to gain from peace. NATO is merely justifying its existence. That's the damning assessment of some legislators.
You said that Ukraine is gradually gaining ground. That's not true. Since you were here the last time, Ukraine has lost territory. 500,000 men are dead.
Some lawmakers point out that corruption in Ukraine is still a major problem. Oleksiy Reznikov was recently pushed out of the country's defence ministry. He was considered one of the West's closest allies. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
...24-year-old Chris Carver left behind a fiancée and an unborn child. His family is still engaged in a bitter fight for justice as they consider his death a murder.
Chris was unarmed at the time of his death. It was caused by a single shot fired by a police officer through the windscreen of a car he was driving in South London. Since the tragic day, his family have said multiple times that they truly believe that if Chris had been white, that the police would have responded very differently. And it's quite possible that he'd still be alive today.
On Saturday, supporters joined his family members for a demonstration outside police headquarters and later the British Parliament to maintain pressure on the authorities.
We've got a police force that, in our opinion, is out of control, and they need to be brought to justice. This is a young man that was unarmed. He was chased by the police down a road at 10 o'clock at night. And there is no repercussions for those people that chased him. We stand with the police. We stand with the family when they say that if Chris was white, he wouldn't have been killed. Chris has been chased and he's been killed because he's black.
An officer involved in the incident has been suspended. However, 1 year on, Carver's family have yet to find out if the police gunman will face any criminal charges. A murder investigation is underway, but the family has expressed frustration at the slow progress of the procedure. To this day, no British firearms officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter after firing their weapon on duty in the UK. Activists believe this may be the case to set the precedent, as complaints of racism against the British police continue to grow. Robert Carter, London.
They have waited years for justice that will never come. Mark Kelly's sister, Carol Ann, was murdered during the Troubles in Northern Ireland.
12 years of age. She was shot in the back of the head. She was shot behind her left ear. And there is absolutely no reason in the world that anyone can give any parent or brother or sister as to why their little sister should be murdered on their own street at the front door of her house.
Mark and hundreds more in Northern Ireland may never have closure now under the UK government's so-called legacy bill that grants immunity to IRA volunteers and to British soldiers for historical atrocities there. It's proving a huge test for Anglo-Irish relations too. Amid a chorus of criticism from around the world, the Republic of Ireland is weighing up a human rights case against London for the first time in more than five decades.
Everyone, no matter who was affected, whether you were affected by IRA violence, paramilitary violence, by the state itself, everyone has a right to justice, some kind of justice, and the very least to investigate whatever had happened to their loved ones. I mean, and that's just the basics, Article 2 of the European Convention, you know.
Under the new legislation, if anyone accused of murder gives information to a so-called truth recovery body, they'll escape prosecution. An attempt, many say, by the British government to hide the truth.
There were hundreds of IRA volunteers that went to jail during the conflict. But if we look at, in stark contrast to British soldiers or the paramilitary RUC, not one ever served a full sentence for the killing of civilians during the conflict. In fact, a number of British soldiers were let out early and given medals once they went back into the British Army. So there's a stark contrast between both. This is really about immunity for British soldiers.
The legislation is now going through the House of Lords, where it's not expected to receive any amendments. And after that, it's going to receive royal assent in just a couple of days. But the victims' families say it's not going to deter them in their pursuit for justice.
3,500 people were killed during the conflict between Protestants loyal to British rule and the majority Catholics who wanted to break away from it. 2,500 of those cases remain unresolved, and it's those who have already paid the most who are being asked to pay again. Saeed Pariza, London.
It has been 22 years since the Pentagon and the two World Trade Center buildings were attacked by planes, ushering in a totally unexpected and deeply destructive era of world history. As usual, in big cities and small towns across the United States, 9/11 was remembered with ceremonies and the same propaganda slogans from decades ago.
22 years ago, hatred and terror did not win. It did not destroy America. Freedom and democracy and the very pillars of this great nation continue to endure.
The biggest domestic legacy of the death of 3,000 civilians may be the internal spying, repression, and paranoia which immediately followed and continues today.
We've gone into a permanent emergency state. That's the key. And it began right after 9/11 with the passage of what was called the U.S. Patriot Act. Everything's a crime, everything's an emergency. The SWAT team raids in America, which are crazy, it's where police are dressed in military gear here. They crash through doors in the middle of the night. They've shot children, old men, veterans. It's so far gone, it's going to be very difficult to roll it back.
Washington's unprecedented and digital domestic dragnet would soon be copied by their allies, especially the United Kingdom, France, and the European Union.
All the great dictators said this, is that we need a sleepwalking people. You need to make people afraid. Once they get fearful, it's called the government needs national security. We need to clamp down everybody. We need to arrest people. And we saw a lot of that, by the way, right after 9/11. It's a way to promote hate against everybody in the world. They don't want us to get along. They want us to disagree. And as long as we're disagreeing and fighting, they remain in power.
Washington's vengeful response to 9/11 was their declaration of a so-called global war on terrorism. It is now blamed for causing 4.5 million deaths, directly and indirectly, and the displacement of 45 million people. However, there's little domestic discussion regarding the awful impact of Washington's militaristic response on the anniversary of 9/11 or on any other day.
The events of 9/11 transformed our nation and how we view our national security. It also transformed each of us individually in ways that we don't always talk about publicly.
The prisoners of Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo Bay, the militarization of American society, the mainstreaming of Islamophobia, so many murdered non-American civilians. 22 years after, the list of victims of 9/11 is still growing. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
One year has passed since the fatal shooting of a British black man by a London Metropolitan police officer, an incident which sparked a huge protest movement across the UK and demands for police reform amid widespread accusations of racism. 24-year-old Chris Carver left behind a fiancée and an unborn child. His family is still engaged in a bitter fight for justice as they consider his death a murder.
Chris was unarmed at the time of his death. It was caused by a single shot fired by a police officer through the windscreen of a car he was driving in South London. Since the tragic day, his family have said multiple times that they truly believe that if Chris had been white, that the police would have responded very differently. And it's quite possible that he'd still be alive today.
On Saturday, supporters joined his family members for a demonstration outside police headquarters and later the British Parliament to maintain pressure on the authorities.
We've got a police force that, in our opinion, is out of control, and they need to be brought to justice. This is a young man that was unarmed. He was chased by the police down a road at 10 o'clock at night. And there is no repercussions for those people that chased him. We stand with the police. We stand with the family when they say that if Chris was white, he wouldn't have been killed. Chris has been chased and he's been killed because he's black.
An officer involved in the incident has been suspended. However, 1 year on, Carver's family have yet to find out if the police gunman will face any criminal charges. A murder investigation is underway, but the family has expressed frustration at the slow progress of the procedure. To this day, no British firearms officer has ever been convicted of murder or manslaughter after firing their weapon on duty in the UK. Activists believe this may be the case to set the precedent, as complaints of racism against the British police continue to grow. Robert Carter, London.
The Democratic People's Republic of Korea Friday celebrated the 75th anniversary of its founding, with leader Kim Jong-un and his daughter observing a large military parade and fireworks in Pyongyang's Kim Il-sung Square. On this occasion, the parade did not include missiles or large weapons. However, analysts suggest such events, which have taken place frequently in recent years, send a message.
These great parades and celebrations in North Korea serve both domestic and international purposes. They show the rest of the world that this regime is standing up to South Korea and to the United States and to Japan, and that it's ready to fire nuclear warheads if they attack North Korea.
Delegations from the DPRK's traditional allies, China and Russia, traveled to Pyongyang for the occasion, demonstrating stronger ties amid a shift toward more difficult relations with South Korea.
The past year and a half have been particularly tense on the Korean Peninsula. Coming to office in May of 2022, South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol resumed large-scale joint military exercises with the United States, and North Korea conducted more missile tests than ever before.
The celebrations in Pyongyang come following reports Russia may purchase artillery shells and other weapons from the DPRK. The U.S. earlier this week issued a stern warning.
Providing weapons to Russia for use on the battlefield to attack grain silos and the heating infrastructure of major cities as we head into winter, to try to conquer territory that belongs to another sovereign nation, this is not going to reflect well on North Korea, and they will pay a price for this in the international community.
Despite that warning from the U.S., multiple reports indicate DPRK leader Kim Jong-un will travel next week to Russia to again meet for talks with President Vladimir Putin. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The sounds of bombs, explosions, airstrikes, and screams are the only sounds the children of Jenin refugee camp have been hearing for years. Today they are screaming and yelling, but this time out of joy and happiness. The Freedom Theater that is nestled in the Jenin refugee camp was established in 2006 as a center for artistic expression and creative activism. The theatre aims to empower the local community, especially young Palestinian refugees, through performing arts. It has become a safe haven for children to heal, if only a little bit, from the unseen wounds they suffer from under Israeli occupation and the recent attacks on their camp.
The Israeli attacks, the Israeli invasion make this place a very difficult place, a very violent place. And that's what we are fighting for, to have this safe space for children. We're fighting to make the children in the camp grow up as a normal children. They have to have normal time as a children. With this kind of reality, while the Israeli attacks all the time, they are scared. They're having problems to sleep in the night. The bombs, the violence in the street. So they don't grow as children.
Minors between ages of 14 and 15 come to the theater 2 days a week to attend drama workshops. The main aim is to tackle the fear and trauma children here are living through, especially after the latest Israeli military raid.
The Freedom Theater is my second home. I love to come here to learn and play, to take part in plays, to entertain other children after what we saw during the Israeli incursions that has left martyrs and destruction and prisoners.
The theater means everything to me. We can find a space to express ourselves after the hard circumstances we go through and after the latest raid. Here I can gather with my friends, we laugh and play and feel safe. The teachers here take us on journeys and we visit other Palestinian cities.
Younger children, however, are the most affected by the current situation, and the Freedom Theater continues to hold therapy workshops for such kids. The theater's experts and coordinators, who directly work with the children, say many of them are too traumatized to speak, and that's why they use art as a tool for expressing what they feel. They say art can convey what sometimes cannot be said.
During the recent raids on Jenin, the children were affected both direct and indirectly. We tried to give them a space just to play. Many of the children returned after the raids, suffering from shocks, worry, and fear. One of our goals is to let children express their feelings. We try to explain to them that there are different forms of resistance. Remaining in our land and learning at school is another form of resistance.
Last July, during the deadly military raid on the refugee camp, many were killed and wounded, and the theater and its vicinity were damaged. But it emerged from the ashes and immediately organized activities to cheer up the camp's children through drawing and singing. The Freedom Theater in Jenin Refugee Camp continues to provide some relief to the camp's children. This theater has survived miraculously despite difficult situations at the camp, Israeli occupation, and more recently airstrikes during the latest Israeli military operation in the camp. Mona Qandil occupied Jenin refugee camp.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked among
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, Assalamu Alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, we're welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. Stay tuned.
گفتارمون با عملمون توأم باشه، یعنی اگر چیزی که وعده‌ای که میدم آقا من 6 ماه اینو تحویل میدم، یک سال تحویل میدم.
Our words and actions must be in harmony with each other. If we make a promise or sign a contract, we must do it on the given time. In the Holy Quran, Surah Al-Saf, Ayah 2, we read, O you who have faith, why do you say what you do not do? Based on this ayah, we must not make a promise that we cannot abide by. This case includes making the smallest promises, even to children or family members.
قولوا للناس حسنا. چقدر آیه قشنگیه. سوره مبارکه بقره است.
In a part of Ayah 83 of Surah Al-Baqarah, we read, Do good to your parents, relatives, orphans, and the needy, and speak kindly to people. In this ayah, we are recommended to speak kindly to people around. Speaking kindly and beautifully to the people who are around us will attract them. Also, kind words can solve many problems in the society. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, for listening to this episode of the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Farahzad. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
From Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
G20 leaders meeting in India should have displayed a show of unity amongst the 20 most advanced economies in the world to find solutions to the world's most pressing problems. But it has failed to do so, even though it is putting on a show of unity. First, there was the absence of China, which chose not to attend this meeting, and then there's Russia, who could not attend due to the Ukraine conflict, or decided to even skip it, were it Russian president to be invited. And in terms of consensus, there was lack of one on many fronts, like phasing out of fossil fuels and the Ukraine war. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at the relevance of G20 and the rise of other blocs like the BRICS. First, let me introduce our guests. Okay, let's go right to our guests. We have Harley Schlanger, spokesman of the International Schiller Institute at Potsdam, Germany. We also have Glenn Deason, professor of political science at the University of Southeastern Norway. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. Looking at this G20 summit, I'd like to start off with you, Harley Schlanger, regarding the communique that was announced, and figure out from you what it means. First of all, let's see. The philosophy that they want to promote is that they're dealing with things like rising commodity prices, food and energy prices are contributing to the cost of living pressures, global challenges, poverty and inequality. There's about, I think, 80 to 100 paragraphs that they all seem to have a consensus on, and they're touting and really are proud of that. What do you think of the G20? I mean, do they have relevance when they haven't been able to achieve their previous goals, and they keep repeating some of the ones from the previous summits into this one?
Well, I think the point is you have to look behind the G20 to see what the fight is. The G20 has the G7 nations, and then it has a number of nations that are orienting toward the BRICS and a new financial structure. And the problem there is that the G7 thought they could strong-arm India into breaking with Russia, create more provocations between India and China, try to use the summit to adopt Western talking points, the unipolar order, continue the war against Ukraine, denounce Russia, denounce China, and so on. But we saw this fall flat earlier in the week at the ASEAN summit, where Kamala Harris, the U.S. vice president, was sent there to, well, the president of Indonesia was talking about cooperation, coordination, and no provocations. Kamala Harris went in and said, we've got to organize to stop China. We've got to support Ukraine. And she was roundly denounced by many of the leaders of the developing sector. So then you project that a couple of days later at the G20. And the idea that somehow you can get India, China, Russia, even though the Xi Jinping wasn't there, the Chinese had a delegation at the G20. But they're going in different directions. The G7 want confrontation. They want to weaken the move against the dollar order. And instead, the developing sector countries are saying, we want to be heard. We want to play a part in this. So they can agree on all sorts of surface issues, but underneath, there's an absolute diametric opposition.
The next question I want to ask you, Glenn Deason, is really not with a sense of humor that I'm asking this question, but I'm wondering whether there should be a G20 or a G7 in terms of a category, when, as our guests there talked about how the G20, we have to look behind that, and then you have the G7, and then, of course, we have the BRICS grouping of nation. There just seems to be too many countries within the first 20 or 30 economies of the world that are being placed into categories. Which categories do you think stands united vis-a-vis the other ones?
Well, I think that, of course, these talks are a good idea because there has to be some diplomacy and discussions in order to, bridge differences. But also, it's an interesting time we live in because we are transitioning now from unipolarity to multipolarity. And, of course, there's great divisions. The G7 are quite united in the goal of preserving unipolarity, that is the collective hegemony of the West under U.S. leadership. Meanwhile, you see the rest of the G20, the non-Western states, there is more of a push towards multipolarity, which is then expressed in BRICS, SCO, and similar organizations. So that doesn't mean that the entire global South is united on all issues, but on the topic of multipolarity, and not wanting to live in this unipolar world, I think that this is a very strong consensus. So I think around this you see clear divisions, but this multipolar world can either be born through diplomacy or in the blood and iron. So I think as the West now, we are looking to confront Russia, escalate further. We want to confront the Chinese by slowing down their economic growth, possibly going to war over Taiwan. I think it's a good idea to speak, but obvious to talk, you know, at least for mutual understanding. And otherwise, I would just say that I agree that not much could be done. However, what is also interesting is that the West could not dictate the G20 yeah. common statement. And that's a very good indicator that that multipolarity is already here. They could not strong-arm the Indians. They could not strong-arm the rest of the world. And if you go and look at the explicit text from the statement, it's quite clear that the Western powers did not get their way and they had to compromise.
So we got to look at how Western media is trying to make things appear otherwise. Because when you read the publications online, it's not really pointing towards that. But I'm curious, Harley Schlanger, why they didn't come out and slam Russia when it came to the Ukraine war. Why was there a softening, as they described it, of the language that had to deal with Russia and its role in the Ukraine conflict compared to at least last year? Why do you think that was?
Well, diplomacy and dialogue are essential, as the other guests said. But the Western countries aren't really interested in dialogue. They're interested in continuing to assert their policies. Now, on the Russia question, the language may be softened a little, but look at what they're doing. The United States just voted another $300 million of weapons. Germany has been pulled completely.
Sorry, is that after the $1
billion? This is on Friday, it was announced by Biden. So you have... And they're also sending depleted uranium shells now to Ukraine from the United States. So any softening of the language was meant to avoid a blow-up. But the Western media still hasn't gotten the message that the Global South is basically saying, we want our voices to be heard. What Modi, the Indian Prime Minister, said is that he would use his chairmanship of the G20 to ensure that the Global South has a say in policies. And so rather than just steamrolling it and shutting down any discussion, there's an aura of cooperation. But the reality is that the West, as the other guest said, is committed to destroying Russia using Ukraine as a proxy war and confronting China and trying to break apart the unity that was established at the South Africa summit of the BRICS 10 days ago. So, you know, the Western media is not going to acknowledge that there's this kind of opposition. They're still saying that Russia is isolated. That's what the U.S. press is saying, that the rest of the world doesn't support Russia. Well, it's not a question of supporting Russia. The rest of the world is saying there must be negotiations, which the Biden administration and NATO have ruled out. So that's why they can't get a consensus agreement on the Ukraine war.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Glenn Deason, what about China, the fact that you have Xi Jinping skipping this event. I mean, yes, they do have a delegation there, but at the same time, does that show that Xi Jinping perhaps doesn't, I should say G20 doesn't have that much of a relevance for maybe China the way that it would in the past, especially when it comes to China's priorities? Is that maybe one way of looking at it or not?
Well, the Chinese have their own concerns. They're not too eager to engage in any diplomacy with the United States anymore because they don't like the way the Americans do their diplomacy, putting sanctions on their top officials and doing this maximum pressure against China, and then using diplomacy as a way of setting conditions for removing some of these sanctions. So they pretty much made it clear that they don't have really anything to say to the Americans before they drop these instruments of coercion and begin to speak, again, using diplomacy. So, but also the Chinese, obviously, they have some of these tensions with India. So I wouldn't write off the G20 immediately, but obviously Xi Jinping not showing up is quite noteworthy. Most didn't expect Putin to come, given that they're in the middle of a war. But otherwise, yeah, I would just like to say I agree with the other argument here. That is, I think that the Western media is largely now involved in managing perceptions, which is why, you know, if you tell the Western public, listen, Russia's isolated, the world is against them, then this is what is needed for the public to continue supporting the war. And of course, it also has some effect in terms of public diplomacy in the global south, trying to portray to the global south, the public there, that the Russians are isolated. So it's said, you know, you fake it until you make it. This also applies in politics. You manage perceptions until it becomes reality that Russia would be isolated. But, of course, it is very disingenuous. And, again, I would advise to look at the actual statements which came out of the G20. I did not see this isolation of Russia.
Well, it's quite a bit. I think it's about 80 to 120 paragraphs. I mean, Holly Schlanger, we've talked many times on many occasions with you also about the fact that there's a new world order. And one of the things that perhaps the U.S. and... really, just the U.S., who is against this globalization many are still a believer of, like China, like Russia. But since they're not, and since the U.S. that is not a firm believer of that, wants a unipolar world, then doesn't that make the G20 somewhat irrelevant when it comes to like the attendance of the U.S.? What I'm trying to get at is maybe before the G20 might have been relevant, but there's been so many changes in the political landscape that perhaps it doesn't make that much sense to have a G20 grouping in the way that it is, unless there are countries that are playing both sides of the fence. Sorry for putting it that way.
Well, first of all, it's now going to be the G21 since the African Union was brought in.
Right.
Although I don't think they're going to change the name. Look, the basic point is that there are two directions of policy in the world. One is sticking with the unipolar order, where Wall Street, the City of London, the U.S., and NATO dictate economic policy and expect everyone to accept that, including when it impinges on the sovereignty of nations. Then you have this emerging trend of the defense of sovereignty and the government saying that we're going to take care of the interests of our people, and that is economic development, and we won't be suffocated anymore. Now, what's changed in the world is that the Chinese are strong enough as an economy with the Belt and Road Initiative. The Russians are strong enough militarily. The Indians are strong enough. And now we see new players coming into the BRICS, such as Saudi Arabia, Iran, the United Arab Emirates, Argentina, new countries coming in that are supporting the idea of a global South development perspective, with much of the emphasis now on Africa. And the African countries, as we've seen with the coups that have taken place against the pro-French governments in French West Africa, we're seeing that the African countries are asserting their independence in a second wave of decolonization. So I think the question of what kind of institutions there should be. Look, the G20 is a good place to fight this out. But the other thing that's going on at this summit is countries that are not part of the G7 are reaching agreements, deals, trade deals, and so on. We saw that at the ASEAN summit, the recent Russian-African summit. There are all kinds of venues. The other guest mentioned the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the Eurasian Economic Union. These kinds of things are happening. They're not going to be stopped by the U.S. asserting its right to control the agenda. The only question is, will there be a recognition in the United States that it should not just temper its language, but actually recognize that it's in the interest of the United States to support this development?
Okay. Let's look at some of the things that this communique in their joint statement actually addressed. And I'm going to just talk about categories here. Climate financing, Glenn Deason was one of them, global debt, reform of institutions like the Washington-based World Bank, and, of course, you have what is mentioned here as a Green Development Pact. Let's take global debt. Let's see where we're standing now. These are issues that have been talked about before in previous G20 summits. If we want to talk about global debt, we're looking at a total global debt that's standing at $305 trillion as of the first quarter of 2023. I mean, what have they done? Aren't they supposed to be dealing with these types of problems? But it doesn't sound like they've really tackled something as big as global debt. Why is that?
I don't have really any good answer to this. It's they are, they stated intentions before, but this is something that is, of course, also.
Well, let me do this. I'm sorry. If you don't have an answer for that, then let's move on to like the World Bank, right? They talk about reforms.
Can I say something on the global debt?
Go ahead, Glenn Deason. I'm sorry. We'll have Harley Schlanger talk on that, and then I'll come back to you. I have another one for you. Go ahead, Harley Schlanger.
Okay. Well, the U.S. just had the debt ceiling debate, and what they did is they basically kicked the can down the road. The U.S. has about a $35 trillion debt, and that's the government debt. It's got almost as much in terms of corporate debt. Private sector debt is growing. The U.S. is the largest debtor economy in the world. Now, the U.S. can cover it by printing dollars and continue to use unfair trade practices to loot third world countries. That's how the U.S. has been trying to deal with that. But that's not acceptable anymore. Now, if you want to deal with debt, you have to recognize that most of it is unpayable at this moment. And what should be done is that there should be moratoria and cancellation, which, of course, the Western banks won't accept. The IMF won't accept. But the other aspect is invest in new technologies and industrialization so that countries can begin to make.
But the U.S. won't let that happen. It calls it competition from China, but we know how they think about that.
But
right?
That's the point. They won't let it happen because it goes against the ability of the West to continue to prop up bankrupt enterprises by stealing from other countries.
Sure.
So that's where the dialogue breaks down. And so you can say anything you want about dealing with debt, but when it comes to actually dealing with it, the U.S. is unwilling to help other countries resolve these problems.
Glenn Deason, what I wanted to get at, basically the thrust of my question was, I just picked global debt, but for example, the World Bank, they keep talking about how the World Bank needs to be reformed. The last time, according to the records, the last time that happened was 25 years ago. They have been talking about reforming the World Bank for so many years, but they haven't done that. There's so many promises made that have not been tackled or resolved or little headway to have been made. Okay, let's maybe, Glenn Deason, you could give us some comments about inflation. I mean, have they really been able to do anything about that?
Well, let me just first comment on the World Bank and general reforms of these international institutions. The reluctance to carry out proper reforms. You can only do this for so long until these institutions are seen as no longer fit for purpose. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen over the past few years an alternative geoeconomic infrastructure emerging. So, for example, with the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, which came up in 2015, this is very explicitly initiative by the Chinese because the existing economic institutions were not reformed. So I think that's why I mentioned that we're transitioning now between unipolarity and multipolarity. The United States could facilitate these multipolar realities which are emerging, in which we would have these common institutions reformed to accommodate these new powers. However, it will not share power. And what you then see is new institutions being created without the U.S., often to some extent against the United States. So this is a key problem. Otherwise, regarding the debt, I think, and inflation, I think this is why the U.S., but also the Europeans, are very deep in deep trouble by themselves, because we've been kicking the can, as mentioned, for down the road for so long now. And for the United States, the problem is especially dangerous because at the moment the debt is so high and their currency now can't sustain this. So they're under pressure to increase the interest rates to defend the currency. However, if you increase the interest rates, then it's going to be impossible to service the debt. So you have all of these problems now, which you can't really get away from, because if they would increase the interest the extent to which is necessary, again, the economy would tank. If they don't, the currency will tank. And making matters worse is, as the U.S. is in relative decline, it will increasingly weaponize its economic system. So we see this through these very aggressive sanctions against more and more countries. And this is why the rest of the world, not just seeing this U.S. dollar being very weak now or inflated and also weaponized, which means they are now desperately looking for alternatives. And when those alternatives are found, that will only exacerbate the problem in the United States, because there's a lot of dollars they exported around the world, which have propped up their standard of living. And if those dollars begin to be sent back home as the world no longer needs them, the United States will have a huge problem. So I don't see any on the horizon any generosity from the United States in terms of writing off other countries' debts, as they are now sinking very deep into this financial crisis, which is coming.
All right, I wish we had more time. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but thank you so much for that, Harley Schlanger, spokesman of the International Schiller Institute. Glenn Deason, thank you. Professor of Political Science at the University of Southeastern Norway from Oslo. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Batahwe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.